Well, good evening, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you all doing? We're almost there. I want to thank everybody for coming, and I think I've said this every time, that this is not a step study or how to do the steps or anything to replace your sponsor or anything. It is time to have some fun and tell some stories about AA, talk about some principles that are involved in our 12 steps, and talk about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and how AA is put together, and just share with you some of the thoughts I have on each of these aspects. Now, we just about wrapped up the history last week as far as the stuff that's in the history books. Obviously, we've been going through things over the last 15 or 20 years, but the historical figures have pretty well faded into the past. And the only two that are really left, well, they're not left, but that I haven't talked about, Bill didn't have any children. He and Lois tried, but they ended up not having any children. So there's no heirs over on that side. But over on Dr. Bob's side, he had two children, a daughter and a son. And the daughter, Sue, ended up running off to get married with one of the first guys to get sober in Akron, Ernie Galbraith, much to the chagrin of those around there. He was staying in their house. That is really taking advantage of your sponsor when you take off with his daughter. So we were doing outrageous things from day one, which is why sponsors don't look surprised when you tell them some outrageous thing, because it's already happened or they've done it. And I put down some notes on this. She eventually remarried her childhood sweetheart, and they had two sons. She passed away in 02, and it was survived by her two sons. Now, the two of them got together before they both died. Smitty was the son's name, and a lot of people around here may have met Smitty, because of all things, he ended up in Al-Anon, marrying an alcoholic. And so that brought him into the fellowship through a different door than his father was in. And the two of them collaborated on a book, The Children of, I'm forgetting the name of it, The Children of AA. And it's very interesting. Smitty talked about his own life, and he was a B-24 pilot in World War II and a very successful businessman. And remarried after his wife died, and a lot of us met his wife, and they weren't married but about a year when he died in 04. The interesting thing when I read that book was to watch the beginning of Sue's story, and she took almost the entire first page to let everybody know that Bill Wilson got too much credit compared to Dr. Bob. And it's funny how that Akron perspective on things continued. It just continued over the years. Henrietta Seiberling felt the same way, and anything that she wrote or was quoted on, it just made it clear that there was too much publicity that went to New York. And to this day, there's still the tension. I think we talked about it before, on the two approaches to AA, the New York and Akron. Now, what I want to talk about before I get to the principles on the 11th step, we have a triangle. You've seen it, the circle and the triangle. And then you know that it says recovery, unity, and service, which are the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we've talked about the steps, which are recovery, and we've talked about the traditions, which are unity, but we haven't really talked about the service side of Alcoholics Anonymous that much. So I'm going to take 15 minutes or so and give you my brief history and summary of that part of the triangle. Now, when you go back to the very beginning, Alcoholics Anonymous was pretty much run by Dr. Bob, Bill Wilson, and the Alcoholic Foundation Board. If you recall, Bill set up a foundation after Rockefeller wouldn't give him any money because he thought money would ruin AA. And Bill said, very interesting, but I want to raise money. So he got the foundation board and set out to use them to donate money to and to raise money. And from the very beginning, Bill wanted to make sure that there were more non-alcoholics on the board than alcoholics. And they hired a law firm to write the bylaws of the original board. And the lawyers had a very hard time figuring out how to put in a legal document what an alcoholic was. In other words, how do you explain being an alcoholic legally? So that it, and they really wrestled with that. But they ended up with three non-alcoholics and two alcoholics. And one of the alcoholics on the board got drunk and had to be replaced. And so that started the thing that, well, we better keep the number of non-alcoholics in greater numbers than the alcoholics. And it became a sore spot with Bill as he felt AA matured and he wanted to change the majority over to the alcoholics. And that board was increased a couple of times, up to nine. And then in 1954, the foundation was over and we created the General Service Board. And since that time, that has been the entity that is mainly in charge of our service. In 1955, it was a big thing for Bill and the old-timers because at the St. Louis Convention, they wanted to... Bill knew that eventually AA had to govern itself, that all the drunks that are coming in had to be in charge of their own fellowship. Up till then, Bill and Dr. Bob, and they would run to Bill, what do we do about this? What do we do about that? But he knew he's going to die. Dr. Bob already had died. And so they had a formal passing on in 1955 of the three legacies over to the fellowship itself. And the General Service Conference became the conscience and director of the organization that you and I belong to. In 1962, the General Service Conference adopted Bill's manuscript on the 12 concepts, which give instructions to the delegates and the board as to what principles they should follow in managing the affairs of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the interesting thing is that that manuscript adopted by the General Service Conference is the only official publication in AA with a byline. In other words, by somebody, and it says by Bill W. Just a trivia thing for those of you who collect trivia out there. Now, until 1971, in spite of transferring everything over, we couldn't resist asking Bill's opinion on everything. You follow what I'm saying? He's still alive. and he's showing up. And he'd drop in the office once in a while, but it was really difficult. And so finally in 1971, when he passed on, we started running our own show. In the back of the big book, just about the last page, are the 12 concepts. And they basically describe where the authority in the fellowship is. They talk to the fact that the GSC is our voice and conscience. And then they establish certain rights. The right to make decisions, the right of appeal, and the right to participate. And that means we all get to participate as much as we want. And when decisions are made, they can be appealed. And so it's a very important thing. And the final one, these are not all of them, but I'm trying to give you a feel for what they are. It is a principle that never should power be centralized in one little group or one person or anything like that. And so that's a very important one of our concepts. So right now, what is managing our affairs are 21 trustees, and Bill was able in 1966 to get the majority of the trustees to be alcoholic. And now there's 14 alcoholics and 7 non-alcoholics that constitute our board of trustees. In addition to them, we have 93 delegates from U.S. and Canada in 93 areas in those two countries. And so we have a delegate from our area, and the way it operates is, if problems are coming up and we want to make sure New York and the annual General Service Conference hears about them and deals with them, or at least thinks about them, this is how it's done. We have our intergroup representative, and we pass on and we attend meetings and find out what's going on in other groups. And you'll see when we get into some of the issues that AA service has had to deal with, that this is really important to participate in this. We also have the General Service Conference, and we have the employees in the New York office. And there's 11 employees in that office, and each one of them, if you've ever been up there, they each have an office, and they have a specific area of responsibility, like literature, setting up a conference, for dealing with people overseas, dealing with the professionals, dealing with prisons and jails. And in the absolute tradition of AA, every 2 years, they pick up all their crap and move over to the office next to them and take over the responsibility. So, like, well, I was in prisons, but now I'm in literature. So that nobody gets to be, I'm in charge. And with that expertise, if something happens to one of them, there are other people there that know how that job is done while they break in somebody new. So it's a fascinating thing to go up to New York, and they just switched offices last month. So if you'd been up there, you would have seen moving day, and you take all your stuff to the office next door. The delegates have a term of 2 years. The trustees have a term of 4 years. And as I said, the GSO staff rotates every 2 years. Now, I did some research and looked at some of the issues, just so you know what has come up. And these are some that I decided to take a look at. One of them was reaching out. In other words, part of AA's job is to carry the message to other alcoholics. And the first example of reaching out goes all the way back to the very, very beginning, when Catholics were having a hard time joining Alcoholics Anonymous. You remember that story way back in Akron? And they came down from Cleveland, and the church said, well, if you keep going to the Oxford group, we're going to excommunicate you. And Clarence decided to start a meeting outside and not call it the Oxford group, and they were able to be accommodated. And since that time, They have made special efforts to reach out to blacks, women's, Hispanics, handicapped, including illiterate. In other words, that became a thing. How do we help an illiterate person who can't even read our literature? What can we do to help that alcoholic stay sober? Pamphlets for gays, Indians, young, old. I can't believe they wrote a pamphlet for old. I don't feel I need any help. They're not talking about me. They're talking about old alcoholics that can't believe that they have the problem, and getting them to surrender and try AA is very difficult. The military, those in jails and prisons. So that was kind of give you an example of reaching out. And so they would have meetings they'd come up with. This seems like a good idea. This is how we can go to jails. This is, and so, you know, our institutions committees. And this is the kind of stuff that gets deliberated. The next thing was the professionals. Now, we didn't have to worry about professionals until the 70s when federal laws were passed making alcoholism a disease. That didn't bring the professionals in. It's when it was covered by insurance. That brought the professionals in, because now you could make money treating drunks. Up till then, you didn't want them in your office. They never paid their bills. And who wants to help them? But now with insurance coverage, so now we have other people advising new alcoholics on how to stay sober. Sometimes in conflict to what they hear when they eventually get to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so we had an outreach program so that AA could go and talk to professionals and make them more aware of what AA is doing. And then we ran into the treatment centers that, geez, the best counselors would be AA members. And when that first happened, I don't know if some of you were around then, it was, oh, he's a two-hatter. That was the term that was being used. He's a traitor to carrying the message for nothing. You follow what I'm saying? He's being paid to carry that message. And they finally resolved it, that he wasn't 12-stepping and carrying the message. He was helping the person get through detox and educate them about the disease and get them ready to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that finally the two-hatter thing, and now many of us work in the treatment facilities with no problem whatsoever and no stigma attached or any of that. We ran into the first time judges started sending people to AA. I mean, I couldn't believe it. A guy came in with a sheet of paper. I mean, when it's the first sheet of paper you've ever seen at an AA meeting, you go, "We don't sign papers." "We've never signed one before, and I'm not starting tonight." I mean, I think I'm capturing the essence of every AA group. We don't do it that way. And so we had to go through the process of educating all the AA groups and talking with judges, and things have smoothed out, and now it's not a major event. Then we have the treatment centers taking people through the steps in treatment, and then they come out, and now they got a sponsor, and they go, "Oh, no, treatment center, that's not the way to do that at all." So we had to work on those types of problems. Then we had conflicting advice to newcomers, pills, and outside experts. The earliest one I remember was the RAND report from the RAND think tank up in Washington, and they concluded AA didn't know what they were doing, that we really ought to be taking alcoholics and teaching them how to drink. And so we had to respond to these various things. And I remember the Sobels were two psychologists from Canada, and they had, all of a sudden, it hit the thing. We have been treating alcoholics for years with our aversion therapy, and we have hundreds that are staying sober. And this was the only time when there was great big numbers. And everybody went, "Wow, this is a really, we have to, what is that? What is that?" And it stayed that way for a number of years until two more psychologists studied the follow-up. Nobody was sober. It turns out they were doing their research by calling the alcoholic, asking him how he was doing. I'm doing great. Okay, we got another. We have another success down there in Utah. Okay, then we went through the types of groups. And this is within AA itself, people started identifying by women. Well, let's start a women's group, or a men's group, or a gays group. In other words, it has nothing to do with having a different disease. It is just that we find comfort in getting to people who are similar to us. And we've used that with women, gay, black, old, young, pilots, lawyers, and doctors. And I find them very useful when you're new. But then it's time to get into mainstream AA, where there's one of everything in the room, and not all around the table looks just like you. Because all you get is the same perspective that you have. And there's nothing like an old housewife to tell a Marine colonel he's full of crap. At a military meeting. You follow what I'm saying? Well, you may fly the plane well, but you're stupid. So. Then we have a thing called meetings. So if a treatment center wants to offer a meeting-type situation, sometimes we call that a meeting. And we take a meeting to a treatment center so that the people in there can hear what a meeting looks like and they can get sponsors and so on down. But it's not a group. Nobody belongs to it. You follow what I'm saying? The other thing was the dual-purpose meetings. And those started up as we got an increase in dual addiction. And people said, you know, I'd be more comfortable just meeting with other people who are dually addicted. And those groups started up, but the General Service Conference took a look at that and said, great, I hope it helps you, but we're not going to list you as an AA group. That is not AA. And so that type of dual purpose, it was felt, and very wisely, that it would start broadening AA and weaken the identification that is so necessary, and we talked about before. And the last thing they said there's still a problem, and we've never really been able to completely address it, of drug addicts who choose to attend closed AA meetings in spite of knowing what the traditions are, because there's nobody in charge. You can't not allow that. You see what I'm saying? There's no rules in AA. And so that continues to be a problem across the country. Okay, the last item was finances, self-supporting. And, of course, they declined outside contributions from the very beginning, even though it was contrary to what Bill's plan was. And they tried to make AA self-supporting, meaning from you and I. You know what I mean? In 1964, when I came in, they passed the word that the General Service Office could function if every member of AA would donate $1 a year. And they didn't get it. They had to get some of the income from big book sales. So think about that. $1 a year? And so when they ask at groups, could you increase, that's what they're talking about. They're trying to make us self-supporting off of us and not off of selling books. And so as we got more successful and the big book, 1 million, 5 million, suddenly people, non-members of AA, are buying more literature than AA members. And our income, if you really get technical on that particular situation, is coming from outsiders. It wasn't a member buying a big book. It was a treatment center and libraries or wherever they're going. So that became more urgency in upping the ante that comes from you and me. And we still I would say the average donation at an AA meeting for all the coffee you can drink and all the spiritual advice you can get and the wonderful fellowship and camaraderie, the average donation is about 1/4 of what it costs for a cup of coffee at Starbucks. And so when they ask, could we put a little more in, don't be embarrassed to put $2 in. That's all I'm saying. I'm trying to share where they are. Bill had this saying when I was new. He said, drunks will buy the bar a round of drinks when they're drinking. They'll set up Madison Square Garden. When they get sober, they're tight as the bark on a tree. And that was his quote. Anyway, the individual limit went from 100 to 1,000. Lois wanted to donate stepping stones. They turned it down. They said, no, we're not going to take that and own it and get the income off of that. So it became a state historical place. And the last thing on that is our magazine, The Grapevine. Now, The Grapevine, I think we talked about it, started out as a little tiny newsletter. And it became one of the great magazines where people could contribute stories and share their experiences in AA. And it was a very powerful thing. A man outside of Chicago just celebrated his 60th anniversary. And I sent him a card. His name is Paul M. And I used to wait for The Grapevine that would have a Paul M. story in it, where he's going to discuss some principle in AA. I mean, he was such a good writer. And it really was exciting. And this is a general feeling across the fellowship that as the years have gone on, while Grapevine became more diverse, it backed off on really focusing on God. The God banner just seemed less than it used to be. And it was more a reflection that perhaps that's the culture that we're in. The country doesn't want to hear that much about God, so we won't put it in there that it might offend somebody. Now, that's just a few people's opinion. I'm sure there's other ways of looking at this. But that's the last thing that I was going to talk about in terms of the structure of AA, the history, and all of that. So now we're just left with the 11th step and then a total wrap-up next week about the whole deal and just some stories, and I hope it becomes a real fun wrap-up meeting. So we're on this step, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Quite a mouthful. And at some point in telling stories, I told you about one of my heroes, Chuck Chamberlain, and his assessment as he got older. And his assessment was, and I think I talked about it earlier, this is for all human beings. There's only one problem, and that includes all problems. And there's only one solution, and that includes all solutions. The problem is conscious separation from God.